Hello and welcome to Symposium of the Lotus Eaters number 8. I'm joined today by Carl.
Hello.
And we are going to talk about a topic that we are both really passionate about. We are going to talk about conservatism and more specifically Michael Oakeshott's version of conservatism. Now, before we start, may I ask you what is your views on Oakeshott in general?
I've only actually read a few of his essays and I've watched a few of his interviews. But he's clearly a very patient and thoughtful man, and he isn't engaging with the foe on the ground on which the foe is comfortable, right? And so he is attacking the paradigm itself, which I think for many people within the paradigm is difficult to understand, because, for example, at one point he says The rationalist doesn't understand politics that isn't just solving problems. And I can completely see some Blairites saying, well, what do you mean? That's all politics is.
Yes.
I can completely see it. And that's precisely his point. He's stepped out of that paradigm, or he's never even entered into it. And he's got such a good perspective on it that it's an excellent critique of modern politics. And this was written like this sort of, this is from the 60s,
yes,
and it was true then, and it's even more true now, because the quality of our politicians has declined.
I must say I find him very insightful, and in a way I think he makes really good predictions. And the area where I see him being a really strong voice that was unfortunately unheard is education. But we'll get there in a bit. I must say that my encounter with Oakeshott's writings was a bit weird, because on the one hand, I encountered the name in Hayek's Law, Legislation, and Liberty, but Hayek is name-dropping a lot. I'm not saying he did not understand what he was saying. It's a really, really insightful book. But, you know, he gives us so many names and it didn't strike me in particular. But I was reading some British Idealism, which is a really interesting and neglected school of thought. And Oakeshott was someone who was somehow educated by some British idealists, and he expressed admiration for some of them. Now, if you look at that school, it's a bit mental, but that's what idealism is supposed to be. So I think his most... The two essays that I think we should focus on today are Rationalism in Politics and On Being Conservative. He is really good in showing the kind of temperament that he's talking about. And as a writer, he does not write in a fast pace. He sort of takes his time. And I think that there's some charisma in that. I'm not going to rush into...
There is a self-assuredness about his writing,
yes,
which is actually really reassuring. And you are right, there is a charisma in it, because he never wastes your time.
Yes.
But he is going somewhere, and he's going to make you just walk calmly along this path with him. And the reading of it is kind of a process, like an initiation or something.
Yes. And I think it is consistent with his philosophy, because many people will say, well, he's not good at fooling you, or he's not good at giving you a speculative account that you're going to say, wow. But maybe that's not the point.
Well, that exactly is not the point. That's
yes.
I'm very much reminded of Burke's... Burke was told the secrets of Rousseau by, I think it was Hume, who had met Rousseau. And Rousseau was like, well, just wow them with spectacle, dazzle them. You know? And that's how you capture the minds.
Impress them.
Yeah, but like in previous eras, it was like with magicians, and now it's with radical political theories. And Oakeshott seems to be the total opposite of that. He's like, no, we're going to go on a walk down a nice, you know, garden path on a summer's day, and we'll talk for a while. And, you know, there's a process that Oakeshott is taking you through.
And we will call a spade a spade instead of indulging in wide speculative
instead ideologies. It's not a tool, or, you know, it's a spade specifically. You know, it's that spade as well.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
I think it is good if we try to give a sort of structure in the discussion.
Sure.
We will start with some biographical facts about Oakeshott. We will talk then about his essay, Rationalism in Politics. Then we are going to talk about his essay on being conservative. And then we are going to have a discussion on reason, progress, and tradition, because Oakeshott has really interesting takes in this. And it's basically pivotal in the in discussions of the relationship of conservatism and liberalism, at least in a classical sense, and also in discussions about what is the role of reason in politics and what is the role of of tradition in politics and what is their relation. So some biographical facts. Michael Oakeshott was born in London in 1901 and he died in 1990. His father was a member of the Fabian Society, many of whose members founded the Labour Party, and the society's leaders founded LSE, the London School of Economics. I read at some point that in his youth, he was somehow attracted to socialism, but not in the economic sense. He was interested in this idea of the romantic revival of spirit, because at the time, many people thought that non-socialist paradigms have nothing to give us. They are, in a sense, culturally deficient and spiritually deficient. And I think that this is partly because their advocates were really hesitant to enter in moral debates. And I think that this raises some interesting questions that we could reserve for the end as to whether we should engage in moral debates in politics or we should abstain from them. Let us keep that for the end. He studied history at Cambridge and he became a Life Fellow at 1925 at the age of 24. He served in the British Army from 1940 to 1945. And then he became a professor of political science at LSE in 1951. He did teach in Oxford and Cambridge before, but that was where he got his professorship, I think. And there he launched an annual lecture of series in the history of political thought. And as they said, initially he was talking about canonical figures, but then he started talking about, he really focused on ancient Greece, ancient Rome, medieval Christianity, and early modern history. So some of his major works are his 1933 Experience and Its Modes, that is not political. He is talking there about how we can have a historical understanding of experience. It's a really interesting book. I haven't read it. I have read some small parts of it, but I would like to revisit it at some point. Here is where his connections with British idealism are somehow more evident. I don't think we can count him as a British idealist, but he was really influenced by that movement. Okay, then another influential work is Rationalism in Politics and Other Essays, which is a collection of essays that he published in 1962. Both of the essays we're going to talk about today belong to that series of lectures, of essays. And then he had a book called On Human Conduct, which he published in 1975. Okay, so let us move now to rationalism in politics. I want to say that Oakeshott is really good in pointing out the precise target of his writings. He is not someone who uses words without qualification. And part of his lack of haste is that he is his, I would say, his desire and him taking the time to show the reader precisely the view that he's attacking. So despite the title Rationalism in Politics, he's not attacking every form of rationalism.
No, it's specific in politics.
Yes, but even there, he is talking about specific kinds of rationalism in politics. So he is really clear about not attacking the Platonist view of rationalism or the scholastic rationalist position. He's attacking a particular early modern conception of rationalism that he, as he points out, is evident in thinkers that we do not assign regularly to the rationalist camp. And he says that the two most evident specimens of his, of what he calls the rationalist temperament are Bentham and William Godwin. I don't think, we can definitely not say that Bentham was an epistemic rationalist in the Cartesian sense, but this actually makes it more interesting to see how a particular mode of thinking captured the whole age.
Yeah, I totally agree with this as well. And this is why I've been spending a bit of time thinking about how would one actually define socialism, because it seems to be the rational organization of society along a priori principles, which is obviously the opposite of tradition. And I think that's a very broad definition. But I mean, socialism seems to have been a very broad movement. You get lots of people like John Stuart Mill saying, "I'm a socialist, but I don't want any of the things that socialists are usually attributed with having." And yes. And then on the other side, you've got people like Marx, who are extreme socialists, and yet they all operate on this same set of axioms where, no, if we just have the right idea, we are now justified in taking control of all of society and reformatting it to our desires and how it should be. And that, I think, is the essence of socialism. And that seems to be like the ultimate rationalist project. That seems to be the politics of rationalism, like laid bare.
I am a bit cautious about this.
I realize I've made some very sweeping statements there.
No. I do think there is there, but I'm worried about, not about the substance of what you're saying, but I'm worried a bit about the formulation, because I think that we are really much conceding to the left some notions that we shouldn't.
Right, okay.
So I do agree with you. This is the end goal that socialists are about. It's, to my mind, socialism is supposed to be the stage that prepares the advance of communism. Communism being the end state, socialism being the means by which communism will be achieved. There is this idea of irrational planning. I think that's the major part that that socialism involves. But I think that when we say this is a rational planning, I think that we are a bit, we may be giving the term reason and rational to the left. And I'm not prepared to do that. Maybe down the line, I change my mind. But at the moment, I think that we are giving way too many concepts to the left and problematically.
There seems to be a need for us to connect this to the concept of managerialism, right?
Yes.
Because I agree with you that obviously, I mean, you know, someone like Oakeshott is obviously very reasonable. Yes. And is very rational in his faculty.
Yes.
But, and so when he's applying that to his analysis of politics in the world, you know, I don't want to say, well, he's now forced to claim to be irrational when he's making his judgments, obviously. But he's not a managerialist, as in he doesn't, because one of it's the systemic thinking of socialism that allows them to conscript everything in civilization to their side, and at least it gives them license to do so if they can find the power to do so. Whereas someone like Oakeshott or a conservative would accept that there are things that belong to other people that they don't have a right to.
I think we could go further in defining the socialist idea, because it's not merely planning and administration. It's top-down implemented planning. It's a top-down implemented and imposed order. Whereas we could say that tradition does involve an order that is not imposed from the top down. It is sort of spontaneous. It arises from the bottom up.
Yeah.
By people engaging in particular practices, in particular ways in which they engage in each practice. And I think Hayek had a nice example he gave, although he did not count himself as a conservative, but I think...
No, neither does Oakeshott count Hayek as a conservative.
Yeah, but I think that this was a good example. He was saying that, let's imagine a field. This field, we just see, you know, the crops and all this. We don't see any discernible path. At one point, someone decides to walk along that path. And if it works, and if many other people start walking down this path, and eventually we will see a path being formed.
Mm.
And he was saying that this could be seen as a custom, that we, no one started by saying, or that person did not start by saying, we are going to make this path in this field. It sort of arose spontaneously.
Yeah.
And also we could talk about that. That is going to be an interesting. Well,
there's a great distinction, a great way to really, really make it obvious to people is look at an American city compared to an English city. All English cities are a warren of different streets that have been exactly like the path, you know, for the hundreds of years, whereas the American cities were all in grid lines, and you can tell which one was the rational city and which one was the organic city.
Yeah.
That's the difference.
And I want to say that also language is somehow spontaneous.
Mm.
No one, it's not that there was a state of affairs where no one was talking.
No.
And suddenly someone came and said, this is what language is. And you are all going to count. It arose spontaneously.
Yeah, it's holistic.
Yes. And there is an interesting idea as to how this gets disrupted, how a spontaneous order gets disrupted by a top-down implementation. And I was thinking that if we look from, let's say, a satellite on how people walk, we will detect some patterns. Now, these are spontaneously arising patterns. They emerge spontaneously. Now imagine what would happen if a government started and saying, you and you are going to, if they try to detect, to command every step, there would be chaos.
Oh yeah. And the important thing to remember is that what people do spontaneously is informed not by a rational calculation, but by an intuitive understanding of the direct environment around them. So it closely maps to the place that they are. Like, for example, if you're picking a path through the field, there's going to be a reason that it winds in a certain way, because there's a lump there, or a rock there, or a hole in the ground there, or something like that. It's going to wind around it. But if you're 1,000 miles away in an office looking at the schematics of the field, you'll just draw a straight line because you don't know. You know, and that's the problem with managerialism.
Exactly. And I think that this is also a point that Oakeshott makes that is really good, is that those who are rationalist in politics, and we will qualify what he means by rationalism, they are really detached and managerial in their perspective. And they forget that they're talking about people in real life, concrete circumstances who live in a society that, for the most part, involves spontaneously arising orders.
Mm.
This is Hayek's phrase. This is not Oakeshott's phrase, but I'm just saying.
No, he's right.
And he is saying that the very attempt to disrupt this and saying that everything will be implemented top down is going to disrupt the spontaneous forces of society. And I don't think that this is wrong. Because we see the deadening of creativity in societies that are strictly managerial.
Absolutely. I mean, that is absolutely true. But one of the things that I've had to study utilitarianism again recently, and one of the things that drives me crazy about this is particularly John Stuart Mill is guilty of this in On Liberty, is the externalization of the problem. For example, here you said, well, if we have a managerial society, then we lose creativity. Well, okay, but that's an external good that you are appealing to, rather than the intrinsic right of the individual to be able to spontaneously live their own life. And this, that Mill is so totally guilty of doing this about free speech. And it drives me wild, because it's just like, no. You have no right to come and tell me how I must live my life. You know, that's the thing. You know, the reason that the civilization, English civilization in particular, works so well is because everyone had a sense of personal responsibility, but also a sense of personal freedom. And so you need to operate responsibly in the domain in which you are. And so a really temperate sort of spontaneous arrangement comes up, and you see it in the hedgerows. The sum of millions of tiny negotiations between people that has settled over the course of centuries.
Yes.
And the idea, and the, but this all springs from people exercising their own personal freedom. You know, it doesn't spring from a manager imposing this on people.
I think that one of the most interesting things to bear in mind here is the Rousseauian view of positive freedom. Mm. We talked about this with Bo at Symposium 2. There is a particular problem with this kind of thinking where we have people like Rousseau coming along and saying that basically in giving myself to all, I'm giving myself to none. Mm. That's just pure sophistry.
Yeah.
And he also says that in a way that if to be free is to be rationally self-mastered and rationally self-governed. And there's a really crucial inconsistency in Rousseau that the process of self-mastery and self-governance and self-development are irreducibly personal projects. He is outsourcing with his philosophy, and many people who think highly of him fall into this trap. He presents the irreducibly individual projects as being something that can be collectively outsourced or outsourced to the collective, whereas they contain an irreducibly personal dimension. And what happens here with the managerial class is that people think that, well, if you were rational, you would do this. Yeah. I can force you to be free, so I can implement the plan that you would choose if you were rational.
Yeah.
And again, we come down with a question of how do we define the substance of reason, the substance of rationality?
And Oakeshott has a good answer for this, because it's always the rationalist that he's defining. He can't imagine that anyone could ever come to a different conclusion than him.
Yes.
And so if they've got this attitude in the managerial elite, you can see how they, you know, design their footpaths and things like that.
Yes.
And they can't even imagine why someone would rationally disagree, even though there may be many rational disagreements.
And there is a concealed, and now it's actually, I would say it's not so concealed.
No.
Yeah, there's a conceit in the managerial class, because they treat people who disagree with them as either idiots or bigots.
Yes.
And when we present everyday people, and I would say the overwhelming majority of the population, when we present them as either idiots or
bigots,
we are sort of paving the way for depriving their rights on the grounds of the ideology in terms of which we pronounce them to be idiotic or bigoted.
Also on the grounds of our own personal superiority or perceived personal superiority.
Yeah.
Which is not very egalitarian.
So let us try to move to rationalism in politics and try to talk about the kind of target that Oakeshott has in mind.
Mm-hmm.
I think we could start by saying some basic stuff about what rationalism is supposed to be and what many kinds of rationalism are, and then locate where Oakeshott comes into the picture and where the people he attacks come into the picture. So I would say that epistemic rationalism first and foremost is an epistemic theory. It is the view that we can gain knowledge by reason. And reason is supposed to be a non-sensory means of knowing. Now, there are many reasons why someone can be a rationalist. And I count myself as a rationalist in that respect. I want to give you two reasons. One has to do with what we call the deficiency argument. The other has to do with ethics. So when it comes to deficiency arguments, there is surprising agreement with philosophers, which is super rare, that the senses, sense experience, cannot establish necessary truths, like the law of non-contradiction. So when we talk about, as Aristotle was saying, that the law of non-contradiction is something that we know by reason, we intuit it. somehow. You could say we have an intuitive grasp of it.
Yes. It can't make sense.
Yes. And there, we could say that there is a rationalistic tissue in that sense, in the epistemic sense, in thought, because when every time that someone utters a contradiction, we interpret this as false. And actually, not only us, the government does it as well. So if for instance, we don't pay our taxes and we they ask us, what happened with your tax? And we say, well, I paid it, but I didn't pay it. Or I didn't pay it, but I paid it. Well, that's a contradiction. It makes no sense. And we frequently use the law of non-contradiction in our criticism of other people to say that this is inconsistent, therefore it's false. With radical empiricism, especially of John Stuart
Just as a quick aside there, I think, what was it? How was it phrased? There's a Latin term that means from a contradiction, anything follows. And
I think...
I can't remember that.
Quod libet.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't remember.
I can't remember. I remember how it follows. Yeah, what the English way. But the from a contradiction, anything follows. It means that there's no logical continuation of what's happening.
Yes.
Right. And that's why it seems to be false. You know, it's just for anyone wondering. Yes. Like it's because things have a logical progression, and the contradiction destroys the logic, and so you can't make sense of it.
Yes. So. And to anticipate a worry that the law of non-contradiction is not inconsistent with change. It says that a particular thing, a particular entity cannot have contradictory properties in the same sense at the same time.
Yes. So it can't be black and white at the same time.
And empiricists have had a trouble with this. And John Stuart Mill, for instance, that you mentioned, and I think that this is a really interesting thing to point out. He doesn't think that the law of we can know that the law of non-contradiction is a truth. He says it's a generalization from experience. There is literally nothing that we could... because he says...
a priori.
He says that the limits of my imagination are not the limits of possibility. Now, in a way, in some cases, I think that's... there is some merit into it, but I don't think that we can do that with, let's say, basic logical facts like the law of non-contradiction.
Yeah.
Our entire mind would be destroyed.
But also, you can identify how that would be the case, because your sense perception could provide you with sensory inputs that are contradictory. And, you know, this happens all the time, where you see or hear something that just seems to be unbelievably out of place, and you can't explain it, and then it's gone, and you think, okay, but what just happened, you know? And it's not that there's anything wrong with your senses necessarily. So that you don't have a frame of reference for whatever just happened.
Exactly. Right? And I don't think that there is a problem with the senses. It's the problem with how we try to interpret
our senses. Yeah, it's about our understanding of the world at that period of time. And so like it's not that, you know, there are contradictions that our senses bring to us. But the failure must be on ourselves and our understanding rather than the world itself, right? And this is what the law of non-contradiction is saying. And this has to be a rational position. It has to be something we reason through a series of logical deductions and not something that we just experience in the world, because we'll experience contradictions in the world all the time. And so it's like, okay, well, you know, so if you are in Mill's position where you refuse to believe that that's something that humans can do, well, I guess you'd end up with his perspective, but it's obviously the case.
And the other problem that I think a non-rationalist epistemology has is ethics. Because if we think that we can only be in contact with the world in a sensory manner, it's really weird thing to say that we can have sensory contact with moral truths. And here is where Hume's fact value distinction comes into the picture. And Hume is really adamant about it, that we encounter a world of physical facts, and we encounter this world with the senses. We cannot derive an ought from an is. Every time that we talk about morality, we do have a conclusion that it is moral, that has moral notions. We cannot derive that conclusion if there are no moral notions in the premises, and the senses can only give us premises that are that involve non-moral terms.
To watch the full video, please become a premium member at lotuseaters.com.